Welcome to the Legendarium Green Team. I'm your host, Kiptan, and with me today are Ashimon.
Hi, everybody.
Dusty Strings.
Hey.
And Huron Fan.
Good morning.
Okay. Today we're here to talk about the second half of The Fall of Hyperion by Dan Simmons. This is the second half of a book, so it's going to be a pretty spoiler episode, but we'll do a brief section up front in order to get general impressions. Okay. How did people feel about the ending of the first half of the Hyperion Cantos? Do you think that you could stop reading the story here and enjoy it? And do you think you could stop reading the story here and have it all make sense? Huron, you start us off.
I was very satisfied with the ending. And as to your second question and third question, I don't know. Like, I think it has a clear ending to most of the arcs that were explored in, you know, the first two books. But it leaves a lot there that's still unanswered. And if you're fine with that, then yeah, I think most people could stop there. But if you want to know more about, like, the origins of the Shrike and, you know, some of the god stuff and, you know, the open-ended questions that were left, then yeah, you should definitely read on.
Okay. Dusty?
This is awesome. Yeah. Somebody mentioned they remember why they loved this so much after reading the second half of Fall Hyperion, and I was 100% on that. I was just forgot so much stuff, but rereading it was so much fun, and I just couldn't put it down sometimes and loved it. As for the ending piece, yeah, I mean, to quote Wheel of Time, it's not the ending, but it is an ending. So it does. it ends right here. You could just cut it off, and you wouldn't have to keep going if you don't want to.
Which is what I did. So obviously, I mean, the answer is just yes. This is a good ending. I liked it. I was very satisfied with it. And like, there are some things that are confusing, but I don't mind having that. I've kind of settled on to a position where I don't really need endings for my art anymore. They're nice to have. But like, after, you know, like, my real introduction to adult fantasy was A Song of Ice and Fire. And yeah, I'm just fine with that. And it, my favorite TV show is Hannibal. Up there is also Firefly. So you know what? Disappointment is sometimes the name of the game, and it's okay.
Okay. As for myself, I love this book. Very clear. I think it does work as an ending. I don't think it all makes sense. And I think that it's very clear specifically which parts make the least sense. And it's like, there's a mystery here, but we can't quite pull that thread yet. But I want to guarantee that it does get explained later on. So
it was cool knowing that this time. Last time I was just, those things I kind of just glossed over. This time I was like,
Yeah.
It has a very clear ending as opposed to the first Hyperion book.
I mean, the first Hyperion book has a very clear ending. One can argue if it's satisfying or not, but it's very clear.
Yeah.
They were off to see the wizard.
I think it kind of ends at the top of the, you know, proverbial arc.
This book, I will say, I think the ending is a bit strange in that a lot of the defining moments are in book two, and book three is really just the wrap up in a lot of ways.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can give examples later for this theory.
So, quick star rating for everybody. I give it 5. 5 out of 5.
Yep.
Agreed.
5 by 5.
Awesome! Then we can go into spoilers. Warning, listeners, if you haven't read or listened to this book, maybe don't go any further. But for us lucky few, let's go.
Yeah.
So I'd like to start with a listener question, because it could really lead us anywhere, and then we'll just see where it does.
Cool.
Red Army Ian says, of the 6 tales from the first book, which one do you think had the most impact on this book? And he says, which one? No copying out to say all of them.
Can we expand this into, like, the most and least?
If you want to.
I think it's pretty clear that Bron Lamia's story had the most impact. The whole Keats persona and the second Keats persona and her story introducing the idea of the hegemony and Mana Gladstone and her story being the central thing of the data sphere and the AI core. I think hers definitely had the most. And, like,
and her father.
and her giving birth to the new Jesus, and her dating John the Baptist. Hers is absolutely the most important, in my opinion.
I can't disagree with that, but I will throw a counterpoint up there and say Martin Selenius saw it all happening.
I think it's the console. I think Lamia is, like, in strict plot terms, probably the most important. But the console, like, he's the one that really pulled back the curtain on the hegemony and the ousters and what was really going on with them. And we don't really get that from any of the other pilgrims. So, like, the central conflict in this story is most tied to the console, in my opinion.
But his actions had the least impact.
Yeah. Are the ousters actually the central conflict?
I'd say no.
The central conflict, it's complicated, right?
Yep.
Ashman's favorite two words.
Yeah.
It's timey-wimey stuff, because technically they are the central conflict if you travel millions of years into the future, however many years it was.
Yep.
If you travel really far into the future, I feel like the ousters are the central conflict. And that's why I almost was like, well, what about Cassad? Because he could be really important because he was sort of the leader, or was he? Like, if he wasn't there, does it change the battle? You know, we're the right person at the right time kind of thing.
Cassad definitely takes actions and he fights the good fight, I guess. But I think a lot of his story is about the futility of physical violence.
He's kind of like a bulldog.
He is super.
Like, in this book, he just sees either Monita or the Shrike, and he just goes to attack it. And that's his entire arc.
He has a job as a soldier. That's what he does.
His sections were slightly more interesting for me in this part of the book than it was in his flashback.
Sure.
I preferred his flashback.
I didn't really.
That's fair. I just, I thought the fight with the Shrike and the thousands of Shrikes, and then, like, getting consumed by the Shrine, and they're like hugging each other. It was
it's definitely more spectacle on his side this time. But I think there was like something poetic about his arc in the first book that wasn't really mirrored here. But
I feel like we got more useful exposition and like world building out of him in this book.
Yeah.
But it wasn't him that was doing it. It was Moneta.
He never said anything interesting. But he just like showed up, and then I was like, here we are, honey, the millions of years in the future. And then he's like, okay, where do I fight next? And she's like, you are the prophesied one. Yada, yada.
Yeah, you must fight these millions of Shrikes.
Yeah, and he also just kind of like, well, he died. And then he was used, like his tomb, and like his area is like kind of, what am I going for? He was morale, I guess, more or less. So the other part of him, even without dialogue, after he was dead, he was used as something. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of his whole story to me. He was used. That's what he was.
He was the soldier who kept fighting, even though he had no chance of winning, or almost no chance of winning.
Mm-hmm.
I think the pilgrim with the most middling impact on the story was Father Paul.
Yeah,
he was witness for a lot of things, wasn't he?
Yep.
Just kind of getting shuttled around from one actually powerful person to the other.
And then he got made Pope.
Yeah, and I'm sure that is going to go great.
He's great, though. I really
He's a great person.
Yes, he was so... I wanted more of him with the other pilgrims and stuff. Like, he was just such a good character. And especially when him and Sol were hanging out and talking, I was like, oh, I love this. It's so good.
Yeah, I really liked his conversations with the father of the Templar religion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And with the leader of the Shrike cult, the bishop.
My favorite part about him is that the first thing Lamia thought was like, oh, he's really attractive. Kind of want to sleep with him.
Wrong team, Lamia.
Yeah.
Our Father Paul has eyes for only one person. It's God.
The human UI.
Yeah. I can't fight Bronn, though, because Severn is this book. Keats is this book. And I'd like to go back and ask a question that I asked earlier. What has Hyperion taught you about Keats? And what is this book's version of Keats in your mind?
I don't know if the book taught me much about John Keats, but I think it's taught me a lot of how influential John Keats and how much Dan Simmons loves John Keats.
That's for sure.
He's like the modern day empathy vessel.
He taught me that Keats had a really good epitaph. I'm not gonna lie, that's an excellent epitaph to put on a grave, although ironically very wrong.
I mean, is it wrong?
We're still talking about Keats.
Yeah, but it's not been that much time.
Well, if we're talking about like, I think if we're talking about like relative to the human species, like other members, Keats is like in the top 0.01%, maybe sure. higher for sure. remembrance. So that's pretty good.
Also, it depends on who you're talking to again. You know, like us, like we know who John Keats is, but if you just ask anybody on the street, are they going to know who John Keats is?
Absolutely.
Maybe.
I think so, yeah.
I live near a university. That's probably, you probably got a good chance.
All right. So there, yes.
You ever seen Billy on the street? People are a lot less informed than you think they are.
Does anyone else want to read like Endymion and Fall of Hyperion and Hyperion after reading this?
To reread them?
No, the original poems.
Oh, a little bit.
Oh, yeah, a little.
Not that much though.
I think I might.
I have a pretty strong distaste for poetry that's really long. The longest poem I like is The Raven, and even that's really pushing it. I only like it because there's a raven in there.
Have you read Tell of the Ancient Mariner?
No.
Oh, Beowulf?
I've been meaning to read Beowulf, but...
The Odyssey?
The Odyssey. Oh, yeah, that is actually the exception, isn't it?
Hmm.
Seems like you're going to like Keats now.
Hey.
Maybe, honestly. We have to give it
a
try.
It'll be the bonus episode after we finish the Endymion arc.
No, nobody wants to listen to us talk about poetry.
Nobody wants to listen to hear us talk about poetry. But speaking of that, did you guys like the inclusion of more long passages of poetry in this part three?
Yes.
No.
No.
I like my poetry short and punchy in books. I can appreciate it more than I did. Like, I don't just skip over it like I did initially. But at the same time, it's like you have to switch gears, and it's pretty abrupt. And then you have to switch gears back, which I'm not a fan of. It really breaks the flow of reading for me.
I think I'm a bit more in that camp as well. Once it starts to be multiple pages of poetry, I'm out.
I feel like I was prepared for this by Erickson.
That's fair.
I think this story would be better if it was only poetry.
You just want Hyperion? The original?
No, I want Hyperion and not in prose.
Yeah, that might have been a bit harder to publish, and it definitely wouldn't have won the Hugo.
It would have been a situation akin to Martin Solenis's attempt at publishing.
The Core would have bought a copy.
The Core would have bought a copy. There we go.
I wonder if the Core like have a public library system where each of them checked out the book one after another once they were done with it, or if it was just straight piracy.
I think it's piracy. It's just straight up piracy.
That's illegal. This is the reason why the Core is evil. They're destroying the book industry.
I do wonder how many disparate core elements there are in total, and like how many books they would have to buy to give one to each of them.
I think there's a lot of superficial agreement, and then underneath that, like a trillion layers of political complexity.
Yeah, I just want to know like how many sentient units there are that would have to have the copyright claim.
Maybe ask Era.
We've got no clue.
We're not contract lawyers.
I was asking more for census information, not legalities.
Ah, I see.
Is there a core census that takes place every 10 deca cycles? I don't know.
Hmm.
I imagine they just have a reference to, I don't know, like a lookup table. How many people are there, or how many IAIs are available at one point, you know?
Yeah, but then people got to be like truthful.
I think we're imagining the core differently.
I'm kind of imagining them as units that aren't actually all that separate. They're all kind of interwoven and intermingled, and the idea of a unitary consciousness for any of them is a falsity that we just hang on to because that's how we understand things.
I'll think about it.
It's hard to say because we get, like, one character from there.
We get two.
Don't count
this. You don't count Albedo?
Oh, Albedo. No. not really.
That's probably correct.
Albedo seems to me mostly just to be a projection of Yeah, like maybe they get together and they project what they want Hegemony to see.
Albedo to me is like the embodiment of a committee with a single mouthpiece.
Mm-hmm.
So who's on that committee? I'm curious, because Albedo is very like, he's playing the game that the Volatiles want.
I think it's unclear exactly whose game he's playing.
But he's pushing the
yes,
the hegemony towards annihilation. So
I think he represents the whatever the majority happens to be at that given time.
And I'm sure there's a lot of back office politics going on inside the core to like decide what he can and cannot say.
And a literal war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you guys like the depiction of war in the data sphere, in the megasphere?
It's good.
The like tsunami allegory.
I like the various spheres, although I really don't understand what the metasphere is supposed to be.
Okay, do you want to go over the levels of the spheres?
I would like you to.
The data sphere is the human internet analog that the AIs have set up, and then those exist within the other sphere. I don't remember what it's called. You just said
mega?
It.
Yep.
Yeah, the megasphere. And that's where most of the AIs live. And then out in the metasphere, that's like the Wild West.
Is that the Void That Binds?
The metasphere, is involved with the Void Which Binds.
Yeah.
But like in real terms, like I can understand that he mentioned, the plank length and plank time. I can understand those words, but how do you construct an internet out of that? Or an internet analog?
It's not a hard sci-fi.
It's not hard sci-fi.
You like embed it into the structure of reality.
Yeah, see, that's I have a hard time wrapping my head around that.
CS majors can't understand stuff like this.
That's true. I might be able to ask one of my professors, and they would give me a complete non-answer because they wouldn't understand either.
While we're talking about the metasphere, what do you think about the other intelligences that live in it? The lions and tigers and bears.
I love that.
What do you think of that concept and that metaphor?
So cool. The metaphor, we're going back to the Wizard of Oz, but like when Uman said that, or Oman, I don't know how you guys are saying it, I was like, oh man, I totally forgot about this. And it was just so like kind of creepy but exciting, and I was just really stoked to like get more into that and to like have that there.
It seems very alien and in a metaphorically resonant way. I enjoy it.
Thanks, Ash.
Yep.
I'm going to make a not very nice analogy, but it reminded me of the Skyward series that Brandon Sanderson's writing.
Oh, okay.
Which part?
I can't really go into spoilers, but if you've read it, I think you would know.
Moving on to our next question, Stormrunner 1730 asks, what did you think of the decision to have the Keats cyborg as an effectively omniscient narrator for most of the book, or at least knowing what was occurring in the other characters' POVs? We covered this a bit last episode, so let's just talk about how we think it ended up.
I love the fact that he became John the Baptist, and that he kind of got his head cut off. And I don't know if he did that just because of narrative purposes or because he wanted to make, a one-to-one comparison between him and John the Baptist and Jesus and all that, but I thought it was brilliant and I really liked it a lot.
I liked the sort of sleight of hand thing that Dan Simmons went about. Like, he did do some heavy implying that the Keats cybrid was Big E empathy, and the bait and switch to being John the Baptist, I like it. I'm not sure what it means. I have no idea what it's good. As for him being like able to see into other people's heads, I think it was maybe a bit underutilized. Like, he doesn't do any editorializing. We get very little of his actual view on the events that happened unless he's talking to someone else about it,
which is why he's John the Baptist. Like, he goes around and tells everybody about
tells the tale,
the things that are occurring. And, was John's. Yeah,
that's fair. But I think there could have been like a slight narrative bias that Dan Simmons could have inserted when he was experiencing things for the first time, rather than it seeming to be just third person limited, if that makes sense.
Hmm. We do get one thing in his reaction to Mayna Gladstone's plans. and her, his reaction to her not freeing the ship, his reaction to her, one might call them atrocities.
Yeah, that's true.
Are we going to talk about that?
But I think it's nice that when he's in the moment experiencing the other pilgrim's viewpoints, he himself has no reaction.
He doesn't have a seemed of a concept of I in those moments.
No, just empathy.
Which is fair.
Ash, you think that Simmons is implying that Keats was empathy? That Severn was empathy?
No. I think that there was like a bit of red herring stuff. I mean, like earlier in the book.
Yes, that was definitely
Alderay was like, yep. Hey, maybe you're empathy. And then Keats is like, no, I'm not empathy.
And Umman was like demanding for him to be empathy.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it actually that Keats had like a choice to be empathy, or was it that Umman kind of got it wrong? Like Umman assumed that he was empathy, but he wasn't. Does that make sense?
They were trying to make him empathy.
They're forcing the issue.
They thought they had that ability. I think they were wrong, personally. I don't think they had that ability.
I agree with Kip.
Okay.
They did end up making the empathy component, possibly, maybe. We'll see.
We shall see.
Maybe. It would be really, really sad if Bron Lamia's baby died. Let's talk about Umon, or Umman, or I'm not sure how to say it, even though I've read this book so many times.
Umman.
The best character.
Oh, man.
Talk about him, Huron.
Okay. So Umon is based on the Chinese Zen Buddhist Yunmen Wenyan. I don't know how to pronounce it, so I'll just call him by his Japanese name, which is Umon Bunyan. He was famous for his one-word nonsense answers, which in this book is manifest as quats.
Quats.
And in this specific school of Zen Buddhism, it's supposed to spur insight and help enlightenment by just like kind of making this cognitive dissonance, or making contradictory, or like just kind of surprise pupils into thinking about things differently. And I'm sure you guys noticed, because like Simmons actually told us that he only speaks in koans.
Yep.
Do you know what koans are?
Not that I could define them.
So again, this school of Zen Buddhism, they're kind of famous for their koans. And koans are, they're supposed to provoke thought in the pupils with like contradictory statements similar to like the quats, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like some of the famous ones are like, what are you all doing studying Buddhism when like the world is such a beautiful place? And like often like these like one word koans are things that are contradictory to Buddhism or that school's thoughts. He once, Umon said, I am not asking you about the days before the 15th of the month, but what about after the 15th? Come and give me a word about those days. And he himself gave an answer and said, every day is a good day.
Okay.
All right.
I don't know if this was intentional or not, but setting up an Eastern-inspired AI in opposition to the very Western concept of Jesus and God, that's interesting to me. Although we don't get any, well, maybe we get people speaking in parables. I didn't notice, but Umon is my favorite character in the book by quite a bit, and he's the one who stands out most when I think of Hyperion, because Dan Simmons really put his work into writing these koans and just these interactions in general. I'm left with an impression of Umon like that's very conflicted. I can't tell if he's just kind of like a selfish jerk or noble in some ways for his actions. Like, it's undeniable that he did a lot of the bad things that made the pilgrims who they are, or at least contributed heavily to it.
Oh, yeah.
And sparked the war in an attempt to force the issue between the human and machine AI, of like something he didn't think that the human UI could win, which is interesting.
Yep.
So he's very mysterious.
He's the one who told Byron Lamia about Hyperion, right? He's the one who originally set Mayna Gladstone down her path.
Mm-hmm.
Who revealed the Hyperion variable.
And he killed a few important people, I know. And
yep.
Yeah, hey, I think he's probably one of the guys who killed Sarai.
Killed Johnny twice.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then the third time, I guess it. I mean, was that him? No one knows.
Let's get into questions of personal identity.
Okay, so when I first read this book, I thought that Severn's actually the first, the second, and the third times I read this book, I thought that Joseph Severn's journey through Italy at the end to his death, I thought that dragged a bit. Did you guys feel that at all? Did you think that, or did you end up loving it like I loved it this time?
I really liked it. At first, I thought it was kind of dragging too, but then when it got towards the end, him dying, I enjoyed it. I don't know. I can't necessarily explain, but there was a lot of like emotion, and it was done really well that I was like feeling it, and I can't put words together right now. But yeah, I ended up really enjoying that part, especially a lot of the stuff about death.
It felt to me like it could be made into a nice short film. Just that segment. And I would really enjoy it.
Would you recast Lee Hunt or would you leave him as is?
I would definitely leave Lee Hunt as is. Yeah, just like this.
Yeah, for sure.
Like the audience doesn't get any of the context, right? They just like this guy is apparently a starship admiral who's...
No. He's made as like right-hand aide.
Yeah, he's a guy from space.
Yeah,
and keeps talking about how he needs to go back to space.
Yeah, but we wouldn't get that without the context.
And then we have Keats, who's just slowly dying, and sometimes talks about how he might be the ultimate intelligence god aspect. Yeah, that's a solid short film. You don't need to explain that much more than that in short films. You can leave things so ambiguous. It's excellent.
So deep.
Did you guys catch that there were quotes from Keats's original, like, doctor in this section?
I can't say that I've read the originals.
Talking about the results of Keats's autopsy.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah. Is that how he should have died months ago? Because he was so torn up and messed
up. Lungs are, like, gone.
They were a pulpy mess.
The worst kind of consumption.
Were those real?
That was a real adaptation of the autopsy notes, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I don't remember my feelings on this section the first time I read it, but this time, yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. Thought it was really beautiful in death.
Dusty?
Yeah, the stuff about there was a couple of times where he like would sit up and suddenly say something and then lie back down. And there was a moment where he started to breathe normally again for just a little bit, like before he died. My brain was like imagining this of like, you know, you get sick and you have these moments where things are better and you feel okay. But the pure idea of knowing that these are the last moments, like this is it.
Yep.
And then eventually it'll be over and done. And so I think that was done really well with some of those moments.
What did you guys think of the Shrike's involvement in his death? It was a little atypical for the Shrike, right?
I was trying to figure out what the Shrike was about this entire book and not succeeding. Like, okay, Manita said that whoever defeats the Shrike in combat gets to control the Shrike. This makes me think that maybe at some point Kasaw does defeat it and the humans get to use it for their own purposes and it's sort of repurposed. But a lot of his actions don't make sense in that context. But a lot of his actions don't make sense in the context of being purely malicious towards humans. So, you know what? I'm left entirely unresolved on my feelings for the entity.
Assuming that the Shrike was created by the machine intelligence and sent backwards in time, trying to flush out the human ultimate intelligence, and then assuming that Kasaw beats the Shrike at some point, and then gets to control it, given that the Shrike is a time-traveling entity, maybe it has to then counteract some of its old effects?
Yeah, and like maybe there's multiple Shrikes in the timeline.
Yeah.
The human UI did allow the Shrike to be sent back.
Well, at that moment when we saw all of the many, many Shrikes, some of that was outside of time and space.
Hmm. Yes.
So maybe it was just
totally
the same Shrike.
Makes sense. That you can really grok and wrap your mind around and be like, yes, I can understand what being outside of time and space even means.
Yeah. Well, but there is a context, right? Because we have like the whole like metasphere and other things like that. So Dan Simmons has created this kind of, not just the metasphere, but with this idea and some other things too about that. Yeah, there's not really like a general definition, but we have context from multiple points.
I would love it if a theoretical physicist would go over this book and tell me what to think about these concepts.
The void which binds. Have fun with it.
Yeah, it's like, I think it would be either like, love. This guy is genius. Wow, I hadn't thought of putting the universe in this way. Or, this guy's an idiot. Why does he, like, he's just taking concepts and applying space things to it, and you can't do that.
I will say, in the Ilium and Olympos series, one of my big gripes is that he didn't invent new words like he did for Hyperion. He just added quantum to everything.
Yeah, that was pretty weird.
So, I thought that the Shrike was the Jesus of the Technocore's god, if that makes sense.
I can understand that sentiment.
The Technocore god is not tripartite. Only the human god is tripartite.
Okay, so he's the incarnation of the Technocore god sent into the past. And part of the problem with the Technocore god is that it lacks empathy, right?
Yes.
And the human god, the empathy portion is supposedly Jesus / Braun Lamia's kid. And so the Shrike was sent back in time to maybe do the anti-Jesus stuff, whatever that means.
The Antichrist. The Shrike is the Antichrist.
The Shrike watched Jesus' dad die in Rome.
Sure.
Actually, touching back on the Eastern stuff, since we know that Amon is very Eastern-inspired, if the Technocore is a more Eastern god, how does that fit in with the story? I'm curious. I don't know much about Eastern religions.
Well, the main tenet of Buddhism is that life is suffering, mm-hmm. and we want to escape from that suffering by, escaping the wheel of incarnation.
Hey, killing all humanity seems like a way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Ooh, but then the Technocore would still survive, so would it?
Because
the Technocore, technically, if their god is more Eastern-oriented, then... Well, I guess the Technocore is destroying itself, but the UI is still alive, so...
And Amon betrays them because he doesn't want to die.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's another Quats, right?
Quats.
His not wanting to die is another defiance of Buddhism. Another teaching, maybe, that runs contrary to his faction's school of thought.
Okay, Hiran, you're going to have to tell me if I'm way off on this. But it seems to me
off on this.
Okay, very good. Thank you. It seems to me that the AIs are kind of analogous to Kami, no?
Can you explain more?
Right. So Kami are like spirits of whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like anything can be a Kami. And Shintoism is a religion very compatible with other religions.
Yeah.
So thinking of the AIs as commies of humanity, in a sense, and having them work towards the ultimate intelligence, it seems like a kind of bastardization of something Eastern religions could do. Like, these AIs are collectively working towards an enlightenment, like an ultimate enlightenment, and then trying to eradicate humanity, which is interesting. These are very half-formed thoughts.
Yeah, I don't see it. Like, Kami really usually don't work together like that. They're kind of like their own thing and really only interested in their own things.
The machine AI does not want to work with anybody else.
Yeah, but I mean, the Kami don't really work together usually, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Like, it's more like, if we didn't assign the word Shintoism to the religion, it wouldn't be a religion, if that makes sense. Like, it's just okay. Like, hey... This house worships this god. Hey, that tree has a Kami. And the only reason that they're linked is because we have stories that link them. It's not like some encompassing idea. It's like even the Kami of the entire religion of Japan is just because it's the deity of the emperor. And kind of the stories are written around that.
More of like a religious framework than a religion?
Yeah.
Okay. Which god would you worship? The one who just kind of blindly stumbled out there, or the one who was designed to be perfect?
Stumble.
I wouldn't worship either of them.
Are you a stumbler, Dusty?
Well, the other one is like pretty cool, sticking people onto a tree of pain. And I'm like, yeah, life is pain, but I don't want to go that far with it. So I'm going to stick with empathy here and call it good. Thanks.
So yeah, we finally got to the infamous tree of pain. What did people think of that monstrosity?
I thought it was interesting that humans are connected to it by what is described as an umbilical cord.
Hmm.
So maybe it's saying something that we're linked to pain even from birth.
Through umbilical cords?
The mother of all humanity is pain.
I've never thought about it that deeply. I just said, okay, practical thing to keep these humans alive while the AIs use their minds.
Hmm. It was a very interesting concept, using it as a beacon to draw out the human empathy. It's like it's a very supervillain dilemma that was given by the machine UI to the human UI. Like,
yeah.
I could see the Green Goblin doing this.
Oh, God. Or Joker. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can definitely see that happening.
It was the Matrix.
Can we get Willem Dafoe to play the machine UI in the inevitable adaptation of Hyperion?
Oh, I hope not.
Just
Yeah, who would you cast as the Shrike?
I mean, like, there's the standard answer, Danny DeVito, but maybe Gilbert Gottfried?
Michael Cera.
Okay, that's all getting cut.
Or you play it straight and give it to Arnold.
Yeah, actually, what I thought about this... Arnold. It is the Terminator. You know how, like, the Terminator movie, one side he's on one team, and then the next movie's on the next team? Like, the Shrike is Terminator, so, yeah.
That's.
Imagine if the Terminator had just, like, blades sticking out all over his body, and he just shredded people in those films.
And said even less.
He's a wild card, so he could be played by Charlie Day.
Yes.
Just recast the cast of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia for the various roles. They can play the entire thing.
Ooh, oh, God. Who would be who?
Who's Sam the Eagle? Or Sweetums? Sweetums would be good.
Are we doing a Muppet casting now?
I think Dennis could be Martin Salinas.
Yeah, that would make Lamia probably Sweet D.
Oh, no, Miss Piggy. Miss Piggy would be perfect.
Oh.
She's the incarnation of pain.
Who's Mayna Gladstone?
That's Sam the Eagle.
Sam the Eagle.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah, it would have to be Sam the Eagle.
I hate Sam the Eagle.
That's not very American of you.
Soul would definitely be played by Kermit, I think.
Yes.
And Keats would be the two old guys. I don't remember their names.
Waldorf and Statler.
Yeah, he would be Waldorf and Statler.
These are crazy casting choices. I just want to say, these are crazy casting choices.
The word you're looking for is inspired. This is the difference between you and I, Kip. I am a human with the capability to make intuitive leaps, and you are just machine-like, and you can only perceive things through logic, and that's why you lose.
Yeah, me and Romance Month definitely agree with you. Let's go back to the ousters. We finally get our first real contact with them and our first examples of what it's like to live on an ouster swarm. What did you folks think? GS gave the biggest smile and thumbs up.
No, I love it because I love the whole ouster thing of it totally talks like our time where everybody's like, oh, humans, no, you have to be this way. We'll just stay the way we've been for thousands of years. But it's like, no, we have to evolve. Like, and it's going to be more than just our society evolves to have cool computers. It'll be things of what does it mean to be human anymore, or gender changes, all of those things. And so I love the ouster idea and that concept because that is what I believe human evolution needs to be.
Yeah, I totally agree. The ousters are the ones who have made the strides, and the console says this at the end of Hyperion. That there are so many things humans need to move past in order to function in this large, impossibly large space with impossibly large numbers. This is very idealistic, but maybe if you get rid of tribalism, that would be excellent. Maybe the Elsiers don't have that in the same way we do.
I mean, it didn't look like they did.
Yeah.
They definitely looked culture-esque, minus the AIs.
Yeah, totally.
And they're just whooping the hegemony. You know, it's not even close, the conflict between them. Which I think is very indicative of, you need to always be changing. You need to always be evolving. What is right for this context is not necessarily what's going to be right for that context.
Okay, I don't think it's fair to compare the hegemony and the ousters in this context, because the hegemony is basically fighting themselves inside the AI core.
But even like the one ouster swarm that was attacking Hyperion, there was no contest between them and like all of Force.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I also loved learning about the ousters, and I think it's really interesting and goes into the themes of transhumanism, which I think are really interesting. Personally, I don't know where I stand on there, but it gives me a lot of food for thought.
So I'm guessing that y'all liked their stance on anti-terraforming. You all like their anti-terraforming stance. We will change ourselves, not the worlds that we meet.
It was very interesting.
No.
Kind of reminds me of elves.
If you were going to change your body type to match some crazy extrasolar phenomenon, like, what would you be?
An otter.
An otter? Live on a water world?
An otter living in a methane world.
That's big brain.
Methane hey. Otter. Ooh.
Liquid methane. Hey.
I'm happy the way I am.
I think the gay community has come up with a wide range of archetypes that we could model ourselves after.
Yeah, I learned about those last night.
Someone's been looking at pictures. I'd want to be one of the ones that's adapted for vacuum and zero G. With the giant like solar sail wings. Look, you put force field in front of the name and I'm in, okay?
Yeah, that's definitely the one where you get the most peace and quiet, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think their book clubs are like? Awesome.
They don't have to worry about editing out background noise.
Yeah. Wow. Depending on how strict their audio files are, maybe you have to edit out the background radiation.
Oh.
Yeah. They probably have to like correct for chromic aberration and things.
They probably have a solution for cosmic radiation.
I mean, they probably got some sort of like light-based communication, right?
Oh yeah, or much faster. Fatlining is obviously a lot faster, though it seems to exist in a different substrate.
Yeah, they use the Fatlines too, right?
But now Fatline's been cut off. What do you guys think about that?
They've been kicked out.
I love the line.
It makes me really interested to read Endymion because I forgot why.
If it wasn't for like basically that, I don't think there'd be anywhere for a sequel to go.
Okay, Ash, what are the things that made the least sense that you think the sequel is going to address?
Made the least sense?
What are the big questions that you have hanging over? Like, what plot lines? Like, I don't know, Hepmastine.
So, basically the big setting pieces, I think. Like, the fat line, the metasphere, which probably the same thing. Like, the same topic. The exact ramifications of what went on with the Shrike and the sort of timeline here. The time tombs are pretty wrapped up, I think. And, of course, Lamia's beautiful baby girl.
Okay.
It's a nice list.
I like it.
Or maybe what did Gladstone say to those crowd people that tore her apart? Ooh, must have been a real zinger.
Anyone else get Hypatia or Hypatia of Alexandria vibes from that?
No.
No,
I don't. Sorry, I see politicians and philosophers as being almost fundamentally opposed to each other. Plato thought it could work. I don't think so.
The philosopher kings?
Yeah.
They're both intelligent women at the end of their eras in positions of power getting torn apart by mobs.
That's true. For very different reasons, though.
Very different reasons, but I admire both of them.
Yeah, that's fair. Hypatia was real cool.
I don't know enough about Hypatia.
The last keeper of the Library of Alexandria.
Okay, all right.
People are also angry at her for talking about philosophy. So I really relate.
People are always angry at people for talking about philosophy.
Yeah, that's true. That's one thing that's never changed.
That's why everyone hates Ashman.
Mm-hmm. I'm the heel of the podcast.
It's true.
I think we can do two more topics and then start wrapping things up. So what do people think of the revelation that the console's device that he killed for was a fake?
I thought it was hilarious.
Man, poor console. Like, he thought he was a free agent and he was
never not getting played.
Yeah, he was always getting manipulated by everybody. And that's gotta hurt, especially since he gave up his wife and son for this.
Yeah. Well, someone else gave them up for him.
Yeah.
But if he hadn't been on this path, if he hadn't decided, I'm gonna get myself in deep and then betray everybody, then this wouldn't have happened. He could have just stayed in Maui coming with them.
I mean, do you think the plan for the console started before the console was even born, maybe?
Could have.
How you feel about the console probably depends a lot on how you feel about free will and determinism.
And revenge.
Yeah, I don't think that free will is a thing in the sense that most people think of it. So I have a lot of sympathy for the console. In a way, I think he's emblematic of a lot of humanity.
Okay. If we're done with that, then who do you think got their wish? The Shrike is supposed to grant a wish to pilgrims, or at least one of them. Do you think anybody got their wish?
They all got their wish in some way, if you think about it.
Kind of.
Okay, Ash, you're done.
Duray wanted to not exist anymore, right?
I think he wanted to exist without the cruciform.
I think he wanted to marry Edward.
Sorry, I meant Hoyt.
Ah, yes.
Well, Hoyt still exists.
Hoyt does still exist.
He does, so that's going to be a big no.
I think Duray got
I don't think he actually had a wish.
He wanted to get rid of the thing, and so kind of, he gets his wish.
Yeah, and the Shrike does it for him.
Yeah, thanks, Shrike.
Duray wanted to die, but another thing Duray wanted to do was prove that other civilizations had had Christ.
Yeah. Ah,
Saul got his wish.
Did he?
He did, yeah. He got his
wish. Dad, I don't think he got his wish.
He got to raise his daughter again.
Yeah.
Which maybe three childhoods is his personal cross to bear.
Insane.
I hope he has a lot of help in the future.
He does get a lot of help.
Nursing packs seem to be a lovely piece of invention. Like,
Saul, best father of all time.
Yes.
Honestly, yeah.
At least dad of the year. And that year could be any year at any time at any place within the entirety of human history and the future. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Saul's dad of the year.
Time travel does that.
Year X to year Y was possibly the longest ever.
I think Martin got his wish. He wanted to finish his poem, and boy, did he finish it on the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Cassad got his wish. He got his confrontation with Monita, and he got to maybe kill the Shrike in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a giant monument.
Yeah.
He got praise.
Yeah. Yeah. The console, he got his confrontation with Hegemony and the Ousters, and Hegemony did end up getting destroyed.
Yeah.
So that's what he was going for.
He burned everything down.
Yeah, so I think, I do think everyone got their wish, except for maybe Hetmestine.
Hetmestine and
Lamia?
Did Brawny? Kind of. I mean, she was raised her kid.
I know she wanted to figure out the mystery.
Maybe her wish was Keith's. Back?
Yeah.
She didn't get it then.
I mean, he's still out there somewhere. Yeah. Right?
A version of him.
He detached himself. Rainbow. He went into the metasphere.
He's somewhere over the rainbow.
Hmm. Yep.
I'm glad that song is still being sung in hundreds of years.
Yeah, it's a good one.
It's really good.
You got to pick the ones that have lasting power, and that's one of them.
Yep.
Can we talk about Mena Gladstone's decision?
Oh, yeah.
And the morality of it?
Yeah, let's talk about her little cabal and General Morpugo, who turned out to be not so bad a guy, after all.
Yeah, that was wild. And then they shot Sing.
That was unexpected, honestly.
Yes.
And then him and his son taking one last, suicide trip together.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron, did you want to go talk about Mena's stuff?
I just thought that it was... I'm not sure it was the right decision to destroy all of the Firecasters. Hmm. And we don't even know what was on that bomb, right, that she destroyed?
We do not know.
We don't know if everybody was supposed to die. They could have put it off at any time that they wanted, right? The techno core. So
no, I don't think they could have. Or why? At least humanity seems to think that they couldn't have.
Okay.
I think that they were unaware of the final plans. I think they had thought that they had clinched the victory so that they weren't paying a lot of attention amidst their civil war.
So it seems like
yeah.
I don't know. I think the whole hegemony is a metaphor for the way that we use technology and how all of that technology has a sacrifice of some sort, whether it be environmental or the lives of others or the labor of others. And the question that she went through is kind of whether that all of that convenience is worth it.
But also, humanity would have died if the Farcasters hadn't been destroyed, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the AIs, in my opinion, there's no question that the AIs would have won if they hadn't done exactly what they did. And the predictions of the machine AI would have allowed them to just kind of grind humanity out slowly and keep them as idiots attached to the cruciform when they needed that. So I don't think they had really a choice.
I think that the Death Wand bomb was designed almost exclusively to kill Bron Lamia.
Oh.
And then once it had been used to kill the pilgrims, the last chance of humanity's UI to prevail would have been gone. And then later on in the hegemony, maybe the weapons would be trusted to the core. Maybe the detonation patterns would be trusted. Maybe a later war would cause more of humanity to shelter in the labyrinths because it had worked the first time. Mm-hmm. And once everyone was in the labyrinths and the Technocore was able to detonate the bombs, they had no more need for anyone else. Hyperion was the last chance to make something that the Technocore couldn't predict.
Yeah, it was the last unfactored variable.
And it was a chance to make sure that that bomb would never be used again.
Technology bad, got it.
Yep. That's the message of Hyperion. It's just technology bad.
Okay.
Don't put your weapons of mass destruction anywhere.
The technology we created tried to kill us.
Yeah.
The technology that connects us, we had to destroy in order to survive.
Well, only because it was a parasitic net.
In order to have this technology and having to go to the stars and connect each other, we had to destroy all of these environments and all of these sentient species. I'd say, moral of the story is technology bad.
But the Alistairs still have tech.
Yeah, I would say the Alistairs are firmly on the side of good.
Yeah, but they're being a lot more responsible with it.
Well, then it's not just the simple line of technology bad, it's the symbiosis of technology and human culture.
Hmm. That's a good line.
That's a lot worse of a soundbite.
Fine, as long as you're not taking that seriously.
You can't sum up the message of the series in two words, then, like, is it even worth reading? Probably not.
Nope.
If you demand to sum up the message of the series in two words, don't read Hyperion.
Who are you advertising that to?
I don't know. I don't know. Not people who are reading Linguist Mage.
Burn.
I don't know when this episode's coming out, but I hope people have context for that.
The fantastic series, Linguist Mage.
It's not a series. Anybody have any last thoughts before we close this chapter?
Oh, I was... just to close the loop that I started at the start of the podcast, part three being mostly epilogue. So Sol gives up his child in part two. Lamia doesn't really do anything besides save Martin. besides, like, go and talk to people. Like the same could say be said for Keats. Like, he does the most actual action. Kassad has made all of his relevant decisions. He actually made that, like, in part one when he decided to kill Manita, and then later on when he decided to trust her. Martin was on the tree the entire time, just doing his poetry stuff. Paul Duray, he followed the Shrike into the Time Tombs at the end of part two, and that was essentially where his arc stopped, in my opinion. His description of the labyrinths was very interesting, though. But, like, again, that seems to me like an epilogue thing that you would normally see.
Yep.
Like, he's not making relevant decisions after this. He's not impacting the narrative with his choices. So, like, the amount of characters making meaningful decisions at this point in the story, it's shrunk to almost nobody, which isn't a criticism. It's just odd structural stuff.
I will say that one of my favorite lines in this book is tiny, but it's about Father Paul Duray stepping into God's Grove, and it says something about the Farcaster transition happening without incident. And this is the chapter directly after Keats gets stranded on Rome.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And it really just brings to mind how much trust people are putting in the Technocore every single time they take a Farcaster.
Yeah, there is a lot of insidious, like, technology is very insidious with how it works. For example, the internet. Like, this is such a mess of convoluted nonsense that we've built huge sections of our society around nowadays. And there are all sorts of ways that it's exploited in ways that people don't even think about.
Yep.
So, you know, good job, Dan Simmons, for foreseeing this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Not really.
Quote, Ummin, we took the rifles, horses, and blankets, and we got smallpox along with it.
Hmm. That was a good line.
That was great.
Okay, anyone else have something they want to add in before we close?
Book good.
Book good.
Yes, book good because technology bad.
Books book great, technology bad.
Yeah.
There will also be no more further misuse of this channel.
Co-host dumb.
See, that was a sequel line.
It was a
it
sequel
will be
line.
Restored when you know what it is used for. Yes.
But at the same time, that like the expectation that sets up, you have to have a big payoff, in my opinion.
Well,
I guess I'll see if it pays off well.
In this series about the evolution of gods, I'm sure that will resolve to everyone's satisfaction.
Yeah. Like the Cosmere.
Okay, thank you for joining us today. We are the Green Team of the Legendarium. We can reach us on Twitter at Green Team Pod. Thank you, Craig, for loaning us this little corner of your media empire. Thank you, Horizon Brave, for getting us started. Our intro and outro music is Galactic Damages and Jingle Punks. You can join us on Discord and yell at us about all that we got wrong and all that we forgot to talk about. Thank you guys for joining me today. Have fun.
Sayonara.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.